Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook, on Twitter, and on our YouTube channel. I'm Dr. Alice Chen, Chief Medical Officer of the San Francisco Health Network and Professor of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, and your moderator for today's program. Our guest is Dr. Mary Nessel, Professor of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University. Dubbed one of the most influential foodies in the nation, Dr. Nessel is a seminal and prolific writer on the politics of food. She's the author of 5 prize-winning books on the subject, including Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health. In her new book, Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda and Winning, Dr. Nessel offers an incisive and comprehensive analysis of the multi-billion dollar soda industry's impact on public health, food systems, and public policy. So this is a homecoming of sorts, as Dr. Nessel earned her bachelor's, PhD, and master's of public health from the University of California at Berkeley. Please welcome Dr. Mary Nessel back to the Commonwealth Club. All right, so I'll start with a couple questions. You guys have your cards, be filling them out, bring them up. So let me start with a really basic one. So when you think about it, we are quite literally what we eat, right? We come out into the world as a 7, 8, 9 pound being, and we grow to 20 times or more that solely based on what we put in our mouth, the food and the water we ingest. And yet nutritional science and policy has only gained traction over the last few decades. When I was in medical school, I can't remember a single lecture that was devoted to nutrition. As one of the pioneers in this area, why do you think it's taken us so long to pay attention to food? And what have you seen change along the way?
Well, I think the big reason is it's quotidian. Everybody eats. And I know that when we started our food studies program at New York University, everybody said, why are you doing that? Why would you study food? What is there about food that's interesting? And I remember having dinner with the provost at NYU and spending an hour trying to explain to him that 1 billion people in the world don't have enough to eat and 1 billion people in the world are overweight and that these are the most important public health problems in the world today. And for that alone, food is interesting. And it's a $1 trillion business in the United States alone. And for that reason, food is important, and he just didn't get it. And it's now 20 years later, and he still doesn't get it.
So why do other people get it? What's changed along the way?
Well, I think obesity is what did it. And what happened was that when the prevalence of obesity increased quite dramatically between 1980 and 2000, all of a sudden everybody looked and said, holy smoke, what's going on? And then a bunch of books started coming out. So Eric Schlosser's Fast Food Nation, and there was a Surgeon General's report on obesity and health, and my book Food Politics came out, and then there was Michael Pollan. We can blame it all on Michael Pollan. I always like doing that.
So talking about food politics, you started your career as a scientist, actually as a molecular cell biologist, I think. And it clearly shows in the meticulousness of your research. Somewhere along the line, you pivoted towards policy and advocacy. And in fact, Alice Waters of Chez Panisse fame called you one of the greatest mudrakers of our time. That's a compliment. What led you down that path?
Well, I love to eat. That's the basis of all of this. And even in my first nutrition class that I taught at Brandeis in 1976, it was clear that you couldn't talk about what people were eating without understanding the politics of it and the economics of it. But I think the pivotal moment came in the early 1990s when I was at a meeting at the National Cancer Institute on behavioral causes of cancer, and there were a lot of anti-smoking physicians and scientists who were really concerned about smoking. And I knew that smoking was bad for you. I knew that the cigarette industry advertised and marketed to kids. I really knew all that stuff. But I'd never paid any attention to it. And at this meeting, there were people showing slides of cigarette marketing all over the world, remote areas in Africa, the high Himalayas, just from slide after slide after slide of pictures of cigarette marketing. And I just never noticed it before. And I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. We should be doing this for Coca-Cola. And there it was. There it was. I walked out of that meeting thinking we should be paying attention to how food companies are marketing, just the way cigarette companies are marketing. And I started writing about it, and I think I wrote my first article about pouring rights contracts in about 2000, and had some other articles about food industry marketing. And I wrote food politics because I never wanted to go to another meeting about childhood obesity where everybody was blaming parents because their kids were fat. I was just really tired of it. Nobody ever talked about the food industry. Nobody ever discussed what they were doing. There were no panels on it. There was nothing being discussed about what could we do to stop food companies from marketing to kids. Yeah. And I was tired of it. I also wanted the American Dietetic Association, which is what it was called at the time, to stop taking money from food companies and to stop doing information sheets and fact sheets that were sponsored by food companies. I lost on that one.
So far.
They're still doing it.
Okay. No. So we're going to talk about all these things: pouring rights, marketing, philanthro-marketing. But let's talk about soda. So we live in a society that's inundated with fast food, with unhealthy food. You've got Oreos, Big Macs, French fries, ice cream. What's so special about soda that it merits a 500-page investigative reporting tome? Like, why soda?
Oh, it's fascinating. I'm really into it. It's sugars and water and nothing else. It's what Center for Science and the Public Interest has long called liquid candy. And the minute you start thinking about sugary drinks as liquid candy, it kind of changes the frame. You would never let your kids eat candy all day long. At least most people I know wouldn't let their kids eat candy all day long. But somehow it's become okay for people to drink sodas all day long. And I was interested in how that happened. There is also, by this time, an extraordinary amount of research that links sodas to poor health outcomes. People who habitually drink sodas have poorer diets, way more, have more chronic disease, have more kinds of problems than people who don't. And while that is association, not causation, there's really a fair amount of evidence right by now that indicates that if you're overweight and you stop drinking sodas, you have a lot easier time taking the weight off than if you don't. And the research base is extraordinary. And because I'm interested in marketing, I was fascinated and have been tracking what Coca-Cola and PepsiCo have been doing for quite a long time now. I'm fascinated by the ways these companies market. And I knew that they marketed to children, they marketed to low-income African-American and Hispanic populations, and when all else fails, they market overseas. And in recent years, I've become increasingly concerned about the way that Coca-Cola and the American Beverage Association fund research. That gives them exactly the information that they need in order to cast doubt on the science that links their problems to poor health. So I thought there was a book in it. When it was suggested to me, I thought it was just a terrific idea. I was a little bit naive in that I didn't understand how many books had been written about the soda industry already. A library. There are enough books written about the soda industry to fill a library, and many of these books are works of outstanding scholarship. They're really, really good. Some of them are about the history, some are about the politics, some are biographies, some are autobiographies, but there's a lot of tremendous information out there, but nobody had really talked about it from the advocacy standpoint. Mm-hmm. And I teach courses in food politics, policy and advocacy, and I was really, and it's obvious that you live in the Bay Area, there's a lot of anti-soda advocacy going on here. And I wanted to kind of bring all of that together because soda sales are down, advocates are winning. That's why the parenthetical and winning in this. Soda sales are down, and they're down substantially. And that has had a big impact on the companies. If you can advocate for sodas, low-hanging fruit in public health terms, an easy target, then you can advocate for a lot of other things.
We'll talk about some of those strategies. But for those of you who haven't read the book, I would describe it as containing startling statistics, tales of intrigue, and confessions of former soda executives. So what was the most surprising or unexpected thing that you found as you were researching your book? I mean, you have tons of stuff in there, but what was most shocking or surprising?
The big surprise to me was that the soda industry does so much work to sell its products. I mean, I was just floored by that. And if any of you saw the New York Times article that came out in August and have followed up on it, that was a revelation about how Coca-Cola funded a group of investigators who had formed something called the Global Energy Balance Network. And one of the investigators has a video in which he says, you don't have to worry about what you eat. Everybody's always telling you to eat less junk food, drink less soda. You don't have to do any of that. You just have to do a little bit more exercise and it'll all get taken care of. And the Times did a really big job on this and made it clear that these researchers were doing funded research that gave Coca-Cola the answer that it wanted. And it was such a public relations disaster for Coca-Cola. Mm-hmm. I talked to about 30 reporters in the week after that article came out, and they were all shocked. I wasn't shocked. I'd just written this book. I was just upset that this hadn't come out before I wrote the book. It would have made my work a lot easier. Yeah. But the head of Coca-Cola International, Muhtar Kent, said that they were going to try to do better, and he had an editorial in the Wall Street Journal in which he promised that they would have a transparency initiative in which they would reveal all of the organizations that they funded. And they put it up on their website, and it is astounding. It's just so long. And you scroll and scroll and scroll and scroll, and you're only at the D's.
Yeah.
And you've still got the rest of the alphabet to go.
I think it was almost 1,000 over the last 4 years, grants that were given out.
You know, if you've got an organization and you're not getting money from Coca-Cola, there's something wrong with your development director.
I'll get back to that, and those who live in glass houses should not throw stones. I'm not going to single out any organization, but let me get back to the research thing for a second, because it really brings to mind that famous quote of Daniel Moynihan's, which is, I think you're entitled to your own opinions, but you're not entitled to your own facts, right? And so what you're describing is that the industry is really trying to create its own evidence base.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the messages that are coming out from industry-sponsored research?
Oh, that the research isn't any good, that there's no evidence that sodas have anything to do with obesity or type 2 diabetes or poor diets in general. And there are many studies that are focused on that people who do independently funded research are just as biased as people who do industry funded research. Public health people have their own agendas. And those are equivalent agendas to the soda industry, and that the main database, the National Nutrition Health and Examination Survey, NHANES, which is the main database that links sodas to poor health outcomes, is so flawed that you don't need to pay any attention to it, and that the real issue is exercise.
Right.
That if people would just exercise more, obesity would not be a problem.
And you had some statistics in your book around if a research study was sponsored by industry, it was 5 times, 7 times more likely not to find a correlation. Talk a little bit about the meta statistics.
There have been actually systematic studies done on soda industry funding of research, and the figure is 85%. So that 85% of independently funded studies find poor health outcomes from among people who are habitual soda drinkers, and 85% of the industry funded studies do not. So that's sort of where the cut point is. And I've been casually collecting industry-funded studies on my website since last March. And I have about 80 studies so far, and about 85% of them favor the sponsor. And there are all kinds of food companies that are involved, not just soda companies, but the dairy industry, the egg industry, the pork industry, the nut industry. I mean, anything that you can think of, industry-funded studies tend to favor the sponsor's interest, because otherwise, why would they do them?
Right.
There'd be no reason to do them otherwise. Right. These aren't about basic science. These are about results that can be used in marketing. A chocolate is a terrific example. I love chocolate as much as the next person, but really, it's not a health food.
Darn.
Sorry about that.
Okay. So let's go back to that list that was on the that Coca-Cola actually ended up publishing. I looked at it. There were almost 1,000 grants. It is a who's who of universities, medical schools, medical societies, cities, youth organizations, ethnic organizations. I mean, even organizations affiliated with the NIH and the Institute of Medicine are on there. What do we know about
their
impact?
They're very generous.
They are very generous. Yes, particularly to health and to youth and communities of color. But what do we know about the impact of this money on their targets?
Oh, they buy silence. And there are two examples. I mean, actually, there are lots of examples, many examples. And I talk about some of them, and others have come out since. But any time that a city tries to do an anti-soda initiative, the soda industry is in there giving a gift. And the most egregious example, I suppose, is the one in Philadelphia, where the Philadelphia City Council was attempting to do a soda tax, and the soda industry came in and gave $10 million to Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and the soda tax got dropped. And there are many, many, many such examples, and I give quite a few. The other example that I think is really worth discussing is that during the time, I live in New York City, and experienced Mayor Bloomberg's attempt to set a 16-ounce cap on the size of sodas. And I talk a lot about what I thought of that initiative. I don't think it was run very well, and I thought 16 ounces was way too high, but I know why they did 16 ounces, but it was way too high. There were a lot of things wrong with it, but one of the things that was really, that surprised the city health officials was that major minority groups, African American and Hispanic groups, weighed in favor of the soda industry and against the cap, even though the highest rates of soda-related diseases are in those communities. And that just floored the health department. They were completely unprepared for that, but if they had known about the soda industry's funding of minority groups, they wouldn't have been so surprised. And it's not just the funding of the groups, it's really long-term relationships. And that started, I have a chapter in the book called Marketing to African American and Hispanics, A Complicated Story. And it's a complicated story because it began in the 1950s when African American and Hispanic community groups began boycotting Coca-Cola and PepsiCo and doing sit-ins and doing all kinds of protests because the companies were not hiring people from those communities and not advertising in those communities' publications. And so there, Martin Luther King on the, this was a surprise, Martin Luther King on the night before he died gave a speech in which he exhorted his followers to boycott Coca-Cola because they weren't hiring African Americans or advertising to them. So that has a long, long, long history. And then the companies, Coca-Cola, after all, is a Southern company. Mm-hmm. And then it took care of that problem. It's now one of the biggest philanthropists in Atlanta. And so the relationships between soda companies and these minority communities are very long-standing, very close, deeply emotional. And very important to those communities. Yeah. And it's not so easy to go in and say, you need to be worried about health at this point. Yeah. It's gone too far. So these are difficult things to work on, but it explains a lot of what the problem was.
And I do want to get back to that when we start talking about soda taxes, which are definitely coming down the line. But I want to bring in some other questions from the audience, because actually one of the more eye-opening, there are many eye-opening parts of your book, but one that really struck me was the one around marketing to children and how the Federal Trade Commission has been essentially neutralized in this area. Tell us about the current status of soda company and government policies on food marketing to kids.
Mm-hmm. Well, the soda companies have a voluntary policy where they will not market sodas to children during children's television programming, and they won't market to children under the age of 12 on television. But television leaks. Kids watch television with older siblings, parents, families. The soda companies have said nothing about marketing to children via sports figures or music figures. The soda machines are still in schools, even though they don't have full sugar sodas in them anymore, except during sporting events and other kind of events. And there are many, many ways, particularly through online devices and personal electronic devices, in which the soda companies are marketing to kids. And most of the researchers who were trying to hold the soda companies' feet to fire say that there's more marketing to children now than there ever has been. The companies deny it.
Right.
I should say, that I came away from this research thinking that that Coca-Cola in particular is a schizophrenic company, and that it, on the one hand, it has its public face, which is warm and friendly and humane and interested in family values, love and happiness. And I say that without any cynicism at all. It's really what that face is. And then on the other hand, there's the Dr. Hyde part, who is making every one of these decisions totally strategically in order to maximize sales and profits. And they don't care who they sell to.
Right, right. There's a public stance of, I think, on the kids issue, like under 12 is off.
Yeah, we don't.
Right? But then there was a quote from one of your former executives.
Right. The one who recanted, the one with the karmic debt.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, there's a guy who was a marketing director for Coca-Cola who left the company and is now in repentance for the karmic debt that he says he owes. And he said, we don't market to kids, that the companies have been scrupulous in adhering to the letter of the, we don't market to kids under 12, but on the day the kids turn 12, all bets are off.
And then 90% of their efforts are like 12.
Yeah, 12, 13, 14. Because if they could get them hooked on Coke or Pepsi at that age, then they have a lifetime consumer. Because people really believe that they prefer Coke or Pepsi, even though blind taste tests show that people can't.
Yeah. Let me put together two questions here, which is really around kind of like soda 101. One being that, one of our audience members was traveling in remote areas of Asia and surprised to note that Coke and Fanta are less expensive than bottled water.
Mm-hmm.
How did that come to be? And then when and how did this change from a once-in-a-while treat to a daily consumption happen?
Yeah, it happened at the same time that obesity happened. A lot of things happened around that time, and I attribute it to changes in agricultural policy in the United States in the 1970s that encouraged farmers to grow more food. And the number of calories in the food supply jumped from 3,200 a day to 4,000 a day between 1980 and 2000, say, and it's now about 4,000 calories a day. That's what's available. It's not necessarily what people are eating. And companies had to sell it. If you've got twice as much food in the food supply as the population needs or can eat, you've got to push food. And a lot of things happened, the two most important were larger portions and ubiquity. So things started being made in larger sizes. That's when supersizing came in. Supersizing, it turns out, is just extraordinarily profitable. And to the soda industry, those sodas that you buy in movie theaters, they cost the soda companies about 2 cents an ounce to produce and sell and package, and that includes the cup and everything else. And you know what you're paying for them at a movie theater. They're just extraordinarily profitable. So the bigger the sizes, the bigger the profits. And then they just made them ubiquitous. So there are sodas absolutely everywhere. And this has been a very long time strategy, where the strategy for Coca-Cola was to have a Coca-Cola within arm's reach of everyone in America at all times. And that's what you want. If it's right there, you just drink it. You don't think anything about it. And you certainly don't think about the amount of sugar that's in it, which is staggering. And the way I remember the amount of sugar, it's 5/6. I can't even say it. It's almost a teaspoon of sugar per ounce. And so if you've got a 12-ounce soda, you're putting in 10 packets of sugar. That's astounding. That's a glucose tolerance test.
Exactly. Yeah, so go home and try it. 12 ounces of water, 10 packets, 12
yeah,
packets
don't
of sugar.
Do this at home.
Just try it. So in terms of all the different strategies you outlined in terms of how people, how the companies have been able to get their product in front of people, the one that really rubbed me the wrong way in some ways the most was this idea of creating AstroTurf organizations, sponsored by the American Beverage Association, then other front groups with names like the Center for Consumer Freedom. It just feels very Orwellian. Like, can you describe to us a real AstroTurf group and how it operates?
You had one here during the soda tax group. And the most amazing thing was that one of your television stations did an investigation and put somebody in New York on it. Someone in New York applied for a job in the organization and got one, and they were paying $13 an hour to collect signatures on petitions against the soda tax. And there was this incredible interview on one of the television stations here laying out the whole thing. And when they interviewed the people who were collecting and asked them who they worked for and who was paying them, and the American Beverage Association was paying them to fight the San Francisco soda tax. In New York City, during the Bloomberg soda cap, they were paid $30 an hour. 3-0. I sent my research assistant out to Union Square to go interview them, and they knew who the American Beverage Association was paying them, or through this AstroTurf organization, to try to get signatures to defeat the soda cap. It was a great job.
And what about the Center for Consumer
Freedom? Oh, the Center for Consumer Freedom. It's a public relations front group for the restaurant industry. And it was it's an attack dog for industries that do not want to go public with those kinds of tactics. Now, remember, the public face of Coca-Cola in particular is a very friendly, warm, open, public health loving, health, happiness, and love and family values. That's their public face. And so you don't want to be exposed behind the scenes of doing dirty tricks. So instead, you hire somebody else to do it. And actually, this group doesn't reveal who its funders are. And it doesn't have to because of the way it's set up. There have been lots and lots of things written about it on the internet. And I don't actually know whether Coca-Cola or PepsiCo funds them. An official of PepsiCo told me some years ago that they did not. And I met recently with the head of Coca-Cola North America, and one of the questions that I had for him was, did Coca-Cola fund the Center for Consumer Freedom? And he told me that he didn't know but would find out, but he hasn't gotten back to me yet.
What has been the response of the soda industry to your book?
Well, it's been very quiet, and if I were them, I'd be quiet too. PepsiCo is saying not a word. They're being very quiet, and they had no comments in response to the New York Times article, which I thought was very wise of them. The American Beverage Association issued a press release in response to the book that I thought was really funny. It was, we are willing to engage with everyone who's, you know, going to talk to us, and then it didn't engage with anything that was in the book. It just said, we're willing to engage. I posted it on my website. And then the International Food Information Council, which is an industry group in Washington, D.C., had somebody do a blog post on it, but it was obvious that she hadn't read the book because she attributed all kinds of scientific views to me that I don't have. So she didn't read the book.
Well, maybe she'll listen to this interview. Maybe she'll listen to this interview.
Maybe she'll listen to the interview. Yeah. I don't know who she is, but that's really all. And if I were them, I wouldn't say anything either.
Yeah.
Because the best thing that could happen to this book would be to have them attack it. And I wish
it would
they
be the
would.
Prologue, right?
I wish they would.
Afterward. So one of the bright spots in your book is the slow but real progress in getting sodas out of schools. Mm-hmm. And so this gets us back to that whole term pouring rights. I don't know how many of you are familiar with it, but pouring rights, time and place restrictions, the role of the USDA. Mm-hmm. Where do we stand today? And in particular, we have actually two folks here from
San Francisco State
University. Yes.
San Francisco State. Yes. Yes.
Who are actively working on this.
Thank you so much for coming.
So actively working on it and wondering, you know, what have we learned and what are some effective advocacy strategies around this?
Well, you have to do advocacy by the book. And I use the Berkeley soda tax as an example of advocacy done by the book. They did everything right. First of all, they had a framing device that worked really well for that population. They framed it as Berkeley versus Big Soda. And that paid off so that when Big Soda came in and plastered the Berkeley BART station with advertisements, which had never been done before, I guess, and people were really offended by all the advertising, they could see this was how Big Soda operated and were not taken in by it at all. And then the other thing they did was they canvassed and went door to door in every single neighborhood in Berkeley, rich and poor. So they enlisted the low-income groups as well as the high-income groups and were able to unify around a common goal. And also, they were pretty sure that they could trust the Berkeley City Council to use the revenues from the soda tax for public health purposes, which is exactly what is happening. And I thought those three things. Oh, and they had Bloomberg money. That didn't hurt either. They had money from the Bloomberg Foundation, which paid for television advertising. So they were in really very, very good shape there. But they did everything right. And so if you're doing that, you've got to get allies. You have to work with every single group on campus to try to bring them in on this. It isn't something that you can manage on your own. And you have to be talking to the administrators at your university who run your food service to try to do it. And I say this in a glass house because I'm at NYU and we're a Coca-Cola campus. Which recently switched from PepsiCo, and it's been impossible at my university to do anything about it because there isn't a large enough student presence, and we can't do it unless students are taking the lead
on
it.
For those of our audience who don't know what a pouring right is,
or what
it means to be a Coca-Cola campus, because we have another question here. Is the world divided up county by county between, or country by country, between Coca-Cola and Pepsi? Like, how does this work, this pouring contract thing?
I should say the pouring rights contracts are contracts with usually universities, but I'll just say something else about that, but with an institution that allows the sale of only that company's products at the institution in return for having logos everywhere and vast numbers of vending machines with those products in there. And these started at Rutgers University in the early 1990s and then spread to other universities and then trickled down to high schools, junior high schools, and grammar schools. And when they got to grammar schools, there was suddenly a big backlash, a public health backlash, again, because what it did was it put the schools in the position of pushing sodas, because the more sodas they sold, the more money they got. And so there were principals who were urging teachers to urge the kids in their classes to buy sodas because they would get more money, usually for sports equipment. Scoreboards were the big things. And it was kind of scandalous. And now those pouring rights contracts are pretty much out of grammar schools, are slowly being phased out of junior high schools and are still very much in high schools and colleges. And they're worth millions of dollars. So that PepsiCo bought a contract with City University of New York a couple of years ago for $20 million. It's pretty hard for an administrator to turn that down.
Absolutely. This is a Commonwealth Club of California program, and we are talking to Dr. Marion Nessel, New York University professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health, and the author of Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda, and Winning. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio, catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter, and see program videos on our YouTube channel. I'm Dr. Alice Chen, your moderator. So as a proud resident of Berserkly, super liberal Berserkly, I just want to go back to that soda tax, because it was exactly 1 year ago this week, right, that it was passed, the first, and I think still only, despite dozens of other cities and states trying to do this. What are the take-homes? Because some of the evidence is now coming out, or studies are coming of the Berkeley, and how does that compare to a place like Mexico, if you want to talk about Mexico's soda tax?
Yeah, Mexico passed the soda tax, too, about a year ago, and the sales of sodas in Mexico are down about 6%. And this struck so much terror into the heart. Mexico has the highest, if not the highest, and one of the highest per capita consumptions of sodas in the world. It's got really lousy water, and the soda industry moved in decades ago to try to promote sodas as a substitute for water. It's sold in 3-liter bottles there. So the soda tax passed, sales are down by about 6%, and the soda industry moved in and went to the government and said, you've got to cut the tax. There was a committee of the government that agreed to cut the tax in half, and then there was a huge advocacy outpouring, and they backed off on that. So at the moment, the tax is holding. And now everyone's waiting to see whether the Mexican government uses the revenues for the purpose that they had promised to use it for, which was to put clean water in schools and to try to do something about the water supply. There is a extraordinarily skilled advocacy coalition in Mexico, the Nutritional Health Alliance, which includes about 30 advocacy groups, of which the most important is Consumer Power. And these people are really skilled, so skilled that the Bloomberg Foundation has put a lot of money into funding them. It was a group well worth funding. I think they're doing a really good job. But everyone is watching. It's being evaluated. They're under tremendous scrutiny, and the politics are tricky. In Berkeley, they're generating about $100,000 a month, which I believe are being used on for child health purposes. So that's kind of wonderful.
Yeah. And how likely do you think this will spread to other places?
Oh, I think if people can emulate the way in which the Berkeley went about doing its tax, that they'll win. But you have to do community organizing, and if you don't do community organizing, it's not going to work.
Yeah. I have two questions.
That's the take-home lesson.
So community organizing around and against kind of the food industry. I have two questions here around the fact that even public health departments are sometimes not taking a strong stand against industry, essentially muzzling efforts by line staff. How do we shift and even pressure those, you know, good guy institutions to taking a stronger stance? What needs to be done to get the Surgeon General to write a report on sugar-sweetened beverages?
Yeah, evidence. And there's plenty of evidence. I mean, really, plenty. I mean, I don't know what to say about public health. I went into public health because I thought it was a change-the-world field. I mean, I thought that's why you went into public health, because you wanted to equalize health. You wanted to remove health inequities. You wanted to promote health. The most democratic thing in the world is to have a healthy population. But there are lots of people who go into public health for other reasons, I guess. And they're scared, and they're not used to taking political action. I mean, I teach courses in food policy and politics. I've got one of my students here. Thank you so much for coming. And I can tell you that a lot of them are really uncomfortable by politics, that the idea of taking action makes them really seriously uncomfortable. The idea of writing letters to congressional representatives, going to Washington and lobbying, talking to their local representatives, makes them really uncomfortable. They would much rather be working at a food bank. Which makes them really comfortable and makes them really feel good about what they're doing. So that's the real question, is how do you encourage people to think that political action is going to do some good? I mean, there's a lot of depression and pessimism about the politics in Washington for very good reason. And it's hard for people to be optimistic that they'll be able to make change. But if you don't do it, who's going to do it?
Right. And so the big area in public health that has been successful is around tobacco,
mm-hmm.
right? How much of what you're doing and you're promoting draws on the lessons of tobacco? And as we then shift and move forward, what other areas is it applicable to? Here I have Big Oil and others.
Mm-hmm.
Other areas of substance use?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, tobacco took 50 years, remember. I think this is going much faster. Much, much faster. Everybody eats. Everybody doesn't smoke. And it's much more complicated than cigarettes. The cigarettes, you just want to put them out of business. The soda industry is much more complicated. It makes products. It makes bottled water. That's another issue that we can talk about. And I have chapters in the book about the environmental implications of all of this. But you have to start somewhere. And to me, looking at it from my perspective, the anti-soda advocacy has gone very, very quickly. It's only been 10 years, and sales are down, of full sugar sodas are down by 20 or 25%. Wow, that's impressive. Still a long way to go. But I could see where it's soon going to be socially unacceptable to be drinking sodas in public. I could see that happening. I'm certainly hearing lots about the social unacceptability about giving full sugar sodas to children, let alone babies.
Right, which is a big shift from that marketing where they had the baby bottles,
with the soda logos. I have one in my office. I mean, those went out of business a long time ago, but everybody at the time thought they were adorable.
Yes.
Until they realized that people were putting into the bottle what it said on the bottle. And you see little kids drinking sodas. And there's so much soda drinking among young children that the Department of Agriculture can count it. It's measurable.
Yeah, as young as two.
Yeah. No, infants.
Yeah.
Baby bottles. And the tooth decay thing, that's another thing that was of how prominent the tooth decay issues are becoming. There's something called Mountain Dew mouth. You know, people who put their kids to bed with Mountain Dew and their teeth rot out, and this is happening in Latin America. And there's a group in Berkeley that's doing a tremendous job of trying to do something about that.
Yeah, I do want to do a shout out to San Francisco. While we may not have a soda tax, the Board of Supervisors, as many of you probably know, did pass an ordinance mandating truth in advertising, essentially. And so for beverage companies to place labels on that warning consumers that they contribute to obesity, diabetes, and tooth decay. So
yeah,
I want
one of those cans. Oh, it's advertising, not on the cans.
Yes,
good.
It's on the
good
on the coolers. Yeah. So I actually want to ask a slightly different issue. So the soda industry's mantra is that a calorie is a calorie is a calorie. So I'm wondering what you make of that recent UCSF study.
Mm-hmm.
It was a pretty remarkable study. I think it was like 43.
Since its author is here, I'm not going to say a word.
Well, maybe 43 African-American and Latino obese children. And only after 10 days, they substituted added sugar for other carbs. So it wasn't about a healthy, you know, vegetable mm-hmm. and fruit diet. It was pizza, you know, chips, other mm-hmm. other carbs, same calories, same carbs, mm-hmm. but less added sugar. And within mm-hmm. 10 days, mm-hmm. there were remarkable changes in their cholesterol, mm-hmm. and their lipid profile, mm-hmm. blood pressure.
They lost a little weight, too, so there was yeah. a calorie issue yeah. in there. But the water. They lost water. you know, if you could do that in 10 days, that's pretty amazing. I think everybody would be healthier eating less sugar. You know, if you want to lose weight, it's a great place to start.
Okay. So then, again, one of like their highs in your book, their lows in your book, one of the more dispiriting sections for me was the controversy surrounding guidelines on added sugar. I mean, you note that it goes back to the 1970s. Can you tell our audience a little bit about the history and ongoing struggles to establish a clear guideline on recommended sugar intake for Americans?
Oh, yeah, nobody wants to do that. The World Health Organization has just come out with a report saying that 10% of calories from added sugar should be the upper limit, and really 5% would be better. 10% is the amount of sugar in one 16-ounce soda. The one 16-ounce soda. So if you have a 16-ounce soda, that's it for the sugar recommended for the day. What's so interesting about that is that that 10% figure has been around for as long as I can remember. People doing recommendations about sugar intake, I mean, certainly from 1980 on, there have been government reports after government reports. The 1992 USDA pyramid, if you read the brochure carefully, it recommended somewhere between 7 and 13% of calories as the upper limit for sugar intake. So there's nothing new about this. But the American government has been very reluctant to get into it. The FDA has now proposed that added sugars be placed on package labels with a daily value of 10% of calories. That is being fought in every way that the sugar industry can possibly fight it. And one sort of weird thing that's going on now is that the sugar industry and the corn refiners, which make high fructose corn syrup, are at war with each other. The sugar industry thinks that sugar is sugar and corn sweeteners are corn sweeteners. They're both glucose and fructose, and we can argue about whether the extra fructose in high fructose corn syrup makes a really significant difference, but everybody would be healthier eating less. It's just that that's not very much sugar in terms of what Americans are actually eating. The Department of Agriculture says Americans are eating 13% of their calories from sugars. I don't believe it. I think it's much more than that.
Yeah. So in terms of a lot of these efforts to either, you know, truth in advertisement, labeling, even caps, taxes, the American Beverage Association stance is really a combination of supporting personal responsibility mm-hmm. and fighting the nanny state. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not the government's responsibility to tell us what we eat or drink, it's ours. And what's interesting is if you follow the public discourse online or on radio shows, it actually resonates with a lot of people.
Oh,
so
sure.
What do you say in response?
That the government is already involved in food choices in many, many ways. And that public health is, if you've got a population that has a very high prevalence of type 2 diabetes, everybody's going to be paying for that. Not only the individuals who are involved. And that we collectively would be all better off if we had a healthier society. And that may, I mean, I think the argument about this is all about personal responsibility is in many ways hypocritical, because the people who make those arguments are okay about some things that government does, but not okay about others, even in the area of personal responsibility and personal choice. But it sounds good. It sounds really American. You know, we're individuals, we make our own choices. The big anti-soda cap thing was, we don't want the government telling us how much soda to drink. You know, well, the government wasn't telling. I mean, this was a badly framed initiative, because it was immediately turned into a ban. You know, within mm-hmm. seconds, it was called a ban when it wasn't a ban, it was a cap. And I think they would have done much better if they made them smaller, but that's just me.
This question is around good alternatives to soft drinks for low-income people who want calories and taste. And I want you to hold that thought and question in your mind, because I think it's linked to what some people have called the obesity hunger paradox.
Mm-hmm.
So 50 million people in the United States have food insecurity. So mm-hmm. they don't have regular access to adequate food. And yet these same people are more likely to be obese. Mm-hmm. Where I work at San Francisco General in our diabetes clinic, up to 70% of people are food insecure.
Mm-hmm.
You have a chapter in your book that's really informative about the SNAP program, also mm-hmm. known as food stamps, what role it may play. So what are alternatives? How does SNAP play into this in terms of a poor population?
Well, SNAP has very few restrictions on what people can use their benefits to buy. And that, too, has a very long history. When the program was first developed, there were attempts to restrict candy. Actually, candy's still restricted, I think. But there were attempts to restrict sodas. And those were defeated by the soda industry then, and all subsequent attempts to prevent SNAP dollars from being spent on sodas have failed under pressure. And one of the most interesting things about it is that what the soda industry has done in this particular instance is it split the anti-hunger community from the public health community. So the public health community generally favors allowing SNAP benefits to be spent on healthier foods, the way the WIC program is. You know, if I were God and I could redo the whole thing, I would set it up so that, you know, you could spend your your taxpayer-supported dollars on healthier foods, and then people could spend their own money on whatever else they wanted to. But the anti-hunger community views that as extremely disrespectful to people who are poor. It takes choice away from them, and they have fought that idea in every possible way that they can, and they're very unified block, because what they really care about is maintaining those benefits. And if you get anti-hunger people alone in a quiet room where nobody can listen, they'll tell you that they, you know, really have a lot of sympathy for keeping sodas out of SNAP, but they're terrified that that will be a wedge that Congress will use to undermine the benefits. And I think they have a point, given what's going on mm-hmm. in Congress. But it's so interesting to me that those two communities are split over this issue. And if you go to Congress and lobby on it and try to talk to people in congressional offices, they'll tell you that until the communities come together and are unified in what they want done, nothing will ever happen.
Yeah. And this actually brings us back to the soda tax, because I think in a number of communities that same dynamic has been happening. In particular, the soda tax vote in Richmond, California mm-hmm. Was very freighted, and would love to hear your thoughts on that. And here in San Francisco, in the context of gentrification, mm-hmm. it was really easy for the soda industry to frame the soda tax mm-hmm. as one of unfair to people of color or aggressive tax mm-hmm. on poor people. Same dynamics. How do we deal with that?
Well, it is regressive. How did they handle it in Berkeley? They handled it in Berkeley by doing community organizing around the health issues and around the big soda issues, and people got it. It wasn't that people didn't get it, they did. So if you can't expect, I talk a lot about race and class in my book because it comes up over and over and over again. And one of the most impressive things that I came across in doing the research was a statement by the head of the NAACP, and I can't remember whether it was New York State or New York City, and he said, and this was with respect to the soda cap, which, remember, the big organizations supported the soda industry. He said, nobody ever came and talked to us about it. The brother never came, was the way he put it. Nobody ever came and talked to us. They just dumped it. Well, you can't do that. I mean, that's not how social change takes place. So if you expect to put in a measure that's going to affect people who don't have a lot of power, you at least have to talk to them about how they can exercise power in that situation. And if you don't, you're doomed to failure, and you deserve the failure that you get. And I thought, you know, I use the soda cap story in New York as an example of how not to do this kind of social change. They did everything wrong. You know, really everything. It was appalling. It wasn't framed. It was done in a way that seemed as if they were trying to sneak it through, and there was no community organizing around it. I mean, it was really appalling to watch and very disappointing. On the other hand, it got a lot of attention. You know, this is a very rich mayor who can do anything he wanted, and this was, you know, I mean, the claim is Tom Farley, who is the physician who headed up the health department, has just come out with a really excellent book, Saving Gotham, which is his version of all of the public health initiatives that the health department entered into. And the ones that did community organizing worked, and the ones that didn't do community organizing didn't work. And he said they didn't have time to get their community organizing in place because they were afraid that the soda industry would find out about it and kill them.
Which they did, yeah. But and at the same time, you point out that even though in many of these places, or almost all these places, except for Berkeley, these efforts have not succeeded, they have succeeded in raising public awareness.
Oh, yeah.
And that's, we so think, the driver of the... So even though the soda industry has no comment to your book, what's their response to this declining consumption?
Oh, two things. One is to produce healthier products. And the other, three things, sorry. Healthier products, the little cans, those little 7.5-ounce cans, you pay more for those. And as somebody once said, if you want large portions, you should be if you want small portions, you should be willing to pay for it. And so they're making tremendous profits on those small cans. They have upped their advertising budget to promote the small cans. And then the other thing they're doing is they're marketing overseas. And they have committed the most astounding amounts of money to marketing overseas. For example, both Coca-Cola and PepsiCo have said, this is a ballpark figure, but roughly $5 billion, that's a B, not an M, billion dollars, between now and 2020 to market sodas in India, another $5 billion in China, another $5 billion in Southeast Asia, another $5 billion in Latin America, and much, much more than that in Africa. Much, much more than that. Coca-Cola alone has committed $3 billion a year to marketing in Africa for 10 years. $29 billion over 10 years. Think about what $29 billion could do for development in Africa. Just think about that. It's astounding. And you look at the consumption figures in these countries, you know, the average number of sodas in the United States consumed is roughly one 12-ounce can, between 10 and 12 ounces a day per capita. Men, women, little tiny babies in the United States, and only half the population drinks sodas, so that's twice as much for the half that does. You look at, so that's, let's say that's 300 or 400 cans of soda a year per capita. Per capita. In China, it's under 10. In India, it's under 10. Think of the way sales could increase in those countries. And so the soda companies are looking overseas,
yes,
to make up the difference.
And is there an extant or existing advocacy structure in those countries to actually prevent what's happened? I mean, it'd be criminal if basically the same thing that happened in our country ended up happening
around the world.
It's
the same thing as cigarettes. It's the same thing as cigarettes. And, you know, there are advocacy groups that are starting to look at it. I mean, there's an enormous collection of advocacy groups that I list and I've got on my website and, you know, all kinds of things. There are just so many. Yeah. And there's some that are international. But remember, the soda companies are funding organizations, so that undermines the ability to get international organizations to take stands on these things. And I have many examples of those.
And in terms of all the different advocacy strategies, one question here is, what's the role of litigation?
Oh, it's really
litigating
important.
Litigating soda as a defective product.
Yeah, it's really important. And I'm not a lawyer, and I don't really understand the legalities of it. But I would say that lawyers started looking at ways to litigate against obesity maybe 15 years ago, 10 or 15 years ago. And now I'm told that food law is the hot new area in law, that law schools are all over the country are starting food law programs, and the people who are going into this are wanting to use the law to promote public health. So I think we're just at the beginning of that. And we'll see much, much more of it in the same way that the most important food safety aspects of the way our food safety system works is a lawyer up in Seattle who litigates all the cases that of food safety problems. And he's a one-person food safety system. There'll be lots of others, so I'm very interested to see how these things will come about. But I'm certainly talking to people in city health departments, in city attorney's offices, in New York City. We have food studies program graduates who are working in the New York City and New York State Attorney General's offices who are talking about ways in which they could litigate food problems. I think it's really important.
And then in terms of food law policy, I mean, a lot of it goes back to fundamental agricultural policy and subsidies. I think a lot of people have heard about high fructose corn syrup. What are some of the key things you would see needing to change in terms of
agricultural policy? We don't have an agricultural policy that's linked to health policy at all. It has nothing to do with it. And in the last farm bill, there were some attempts to get some money into the farm bill that would support fruit and vegetable production or marketing, or whatever. And they were just thrilled that they got, you know, $100 million or something over the 10 years of the farm bill. That's a rounding error in the farm bill. It's so small. I mean, it's just so minuscule. The money still goes. We don't have direct subsidies anymore, which is a step forward, but the federal taxpayers support the crop insurance for major commodities that are the basis of junk foods. Mm-hmm. And we have other policies that protect sugar growers, cane and beet growers. And actually keep the price of sugar high, but not high enough to discourage sales. But none of these policies are linked to health policy. And that's the big flaw. If you were going to do one change, you would want to sit down and say, how can we use this ridiculous $100 billion a year bill to promote the health of citizens, to make food healthier, to have I hate to use the word sustainability because that's the S word these days, but a more sustainable and healthier food system from which we would all benefit.
Absolutely. So you've done soda. What's next?
Conflict of interest. That's going to be the next project. I mean, it grew right out of this when that Times article came out. And all of this soda industry funding of researchers and individuals came out. I thought, oh, there's a book in there. It won't happen soon, but there's a book in there, and I'm starting to work on that.
Penultimate question. Can you talk about GMOs in soda?
Well, if it's got corn syrup, it's GMO, because 90-95% of the corn in the United States is genetically modified. And that's one of the reasons why the soda companies were such generous funders of the anti-labeling programs in Washington, California, and Oregon. And that was revealed in here's where legal action comes in. There was a lawsuit in Oregon that forced the grocery manufacturers to reveal, which was a big funder of the anti-labeling initiative, to reveal who had funded them. And it was clear that Coca-Cola and PepsiCo and the American Beverage Association were funders. Anyway, Coke and Pepsi were funders of the anti labeling initiatives, and they don't, you know, I don't really understand the whole labeling thing. I was on the FDA Food Advisory Committee in 1994 when the issue of labeling came up, and we said, you know, you really have to label these things. If you don't label these things, people are going to worry about what's in them, and they won't trust you. And they looked at us like we were crazy. So the only thing that surprises me about GMO labeling is it took this long.
So we've reached the point in our program. We have time for one last question. So what I'll ask you is, the Super Bowl is going to be in San Francisco.
Oh, lucky
next year.
You.
Yeah, lucky us. if you had an opportunity to air a PSA during the Super Bowl, what would your messages be?
Eat your veggies.
Excellent. Our thanks to Dr. Mary Nessel, New York University professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health, the author of Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda and Winning. We also want to thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the internet. I'm Dr. Alice Chen, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.